that such methods were sometimes needed to prove a conspiracy, and that such lines had been crossed 1,000 times by private investigators. Burns perfectly embodied the new profession. That summer, the team of operatives hired by Mathis began to infiltrate Osage County. Each agent identified himself in his daily reports only by a coded number. At the outset, operative number 10 asked Mathis, who'd been a juror on the inquest, to show him the crime scene. Mathis and myself drove out to the place where the body was found, number 10 wrote. One of the investigators spoke to Anna's main servant. She revealed that after the body was found, she'd obtained a set of Anna's keys and had gone with Anna's sister Rita Smith to Anna's house. Incredibly, no one from the sheriff's office had searched the place yet. The women eased open the door and stepped through the silence. They could see Anna's jewelry and blankets and pictures, the accumulated treasures of her life now resembling the ruins of a lost city. The servant who had helped dress Anna the day she disappeared recalled, "Everything was just as we left it, except for one thing." Anna's alligator purse, which he had taken to Molly's luncheon, was now lying on the floor, the servant said, with everything torn out of it. Nothing else in the house appeared to have been stolen, and the presence of the bag indicated that Anna had likely returned to her house at some point after the luncheon. Molly's brother-in-law, Brian, seemed to be telling the truth about having brought her home. But had he taken her back out? Or had she gone away with someone else? Number 10 turned to another potentially rich vein of clues, the records of Anna's incoming and outgoing telephone calls. In those days, phone calls were manually patched through by an operator at a switchboard, with long-distance calls often relayed through multiple switchboards. These operators frequently kept a written record of the calls. According to the log of a Fairfax operator, at about 8:30 on the night Anna disappeared, someone had rung her house from a phone belonging to a business in Ralston, a town 6 miles southwest of Greyhorse. The records showed that someone, presumably Anna, had picked up. That meant that Anna was likely still in her house at 8:30, further evidence that Brian had been truthful about taking her home. The private detective, sensing that he was on the verge of a breakthrough, hurried to the Ralston business where the call originated. The proprietor insisted that he hadn't called Anna's house, and that nobody else would have been allowed to make a long-distance call from his phone. Bolstering his claims, no Ralston operator had a record of the call being patched through to the Fairfax operator. "This call seems a mystery," number 10 wrote. He suspected that the Ralston number was really a blind, that an operator had been paid to destroy the original log ticket, which revealed the true source of the call. Someone, it seemed, was covering his or her tracks. Number 10 wanted to look closely at Oda Brown. "General suspicion points toward the divorced husband," he wrote. But it was getting late, and he finished his report saying, "Discontinued on case, 11 p.m. A week later, another operative from the team, number 46, was sent to locate Brown in Ponca City, 25 miles northwest of Greyhorse. A savage storm blew across the prairie and turned the streets into rivers of mud, so the private detective didn't arrive in Ponca City until dark, only to discover that Brown wasn't there. He was said to be visiting Perry, Oklahoma, where his father lived. The next day, Number 46 took a train south to Perry, but Brown wasn't there either. He was now said to be in Pawnee County. "Consequently, I left Perry on the first train," Number 46 wrote in his report. This was what Sherlock Holmes' stories left out: the tedium of real detective work, the false leads, and the dead ends. Back and forth, Number 46 went until, in Pawnee County, he spied a slender, cigarette-smoking, shifty-looking man with rust-colored hair and flat, gray eyes. Oda Brown. He was with a Pawnee woman, whom he'd reportedly married after Anna's death. Number 46 stayed close, shadowing them. One day, Number 46 approached Brown, trying to befriend him. The Pinkerton Manual advised, "The watchful detective will seize the criminal in his weakest moments and force from him, by his sympathy and the confidence which the criminal has in him, the secret which devours him." Number 46 wormed his way deeper into Brown's confidence. When Brown mentioned that his ex-wife had been murdered, Number 46 tried to elicit from him where he'd been at the time of her death. Brown, perhaps suspecting his new friend was a professional snoop, said that he'd been away with another woman, though he wouldn't disclose the location. Number 46 studied Brown intently. According to the manual, a criminal's secret becomes an enemy within him and weakens the whole fortress of his strength. But Brown didn't appear at all nervous. While Number 46 was working on Brown, another operative, Number 28, learned a seemingly vital secret from a young Kaw Indian woman who lived near the western border of Osage County. In a signed statement, the woman claimed that Rose Osage, an Indian in Fairfax, had admitted to her that she'd killed Anna after Anna had tried to seduce her boyfriend, Joe Allen. Rose said that while the three were riding in a car, she'd shot her on the top of her head, then, with Joe's help, dumped the body by Three Mile Creek. Rose's clothes got spattered with Anna's blood, the story went, so she took them off and discarded them in the creek. It was a grim tale, but operative Number 28 was buoyed by the discovery. In his daily report, he said that he'd spent hours with Mathis and Sheriff Frias, whose trial was still pending, pursuing this clue that seems to be a lead on the case. The private detectives, though, struggled to corroborate the informant's story. No one had spotted Anna with Rose or Joe, nor were any clothes found in the stream by the body. Was it possible that the informant was simply lying to get the reward? Sheriff Frias, his flesh unfolding from his voluminous neck and chest, urged the private detectives to discount Rose and her boyfriend as suspects. Then he offered a counter-rumor. Two hard-boiled characters from the oil camps had purportedly been seen with Anna shortly before her death, and had afterwards skipped town. The private detectives agreed to look into the sheriff's story. But concerning the allegations against Rose, Number 28 vowed, "We are going to follow out this theory." The private detectives shared what they knew with Bill Smith, Molly's brother-in-law, who was still conducting his own investigation. The 29-year-old Smith had been a horse thief before attaching himself to an Osage fortune, first by marrying Molly's sister Minnie, and then, only months after Minnie's death from the mysterious wasting illness in 1918, by wedding Molly's sister Rita. On more than one occasion when Bill drank, He'd raised his hand to Rita. A servant later recalled that after one row between Bill and Rita, she came out kind of bruised up. Bill told the servant that was the only way to get along with them squaws. Rita often threatened to leave him, but she never did. Rita had a keen mind, yet those close to her thought that her judgment was impaired by what one person described as a love that was truly blind. Molly had her doubts about Bill. Had he in some way been responsible for Minnie's death? Hale made it clear that he didn't trust Bill either, and at least one local attorney speculated that Bill was prostituting the sacred bond of marriage for sordid gain. But since Anna's murder, Bill had, by all appearances, vigorously sought to discover who the culprit was. When Bill learned that a tailor in town might have information, he went with a private detective to ask him questions, only to find that he was spreading the now familiar rumor that Rose Osage had killed Anna in a fury of jealousy. Desperate for a break, the private detectives decided to install a listening device to eavesdrop on Rose and her boyfriend. At the time, statutes governing electronic surveillance were nebulous, and Burns was an avid user of a dictograph, a primitive listening device that could be concealed in anything from a clock to a chandelier. Burns was the first American to see the immense possibilities of the instrument in detective work, the Literary Digest reported in 1912. He is so enamored with it that he always carries one in his pocket. Just as Alan Pinkerton in the 19th century was known as the eye, Burns in the 20th century had become the ear. The detectives, hiding in another room, began listening to the staticky voices of Rose and her boyfriend through earphones, but, as is so often the case with surveillance, the rush of excitement gave way to the tediousness of other people's inner lives, and the private detectives eventually stopped bothering to jot down the innocuous details that they overheard. Using more conventional means, however, the private detectives made a startling discovery. The cab driver who'd taken Anna to Molly's house on the day she vanished told them that Anna had asked him to stop first at the cemetery in Greyhorse. She had climbed out and stumbled through the stones until she paused by her father's tomb. For a moment, she stood near the spot where she too would soon be buried, as if offering a morning prayer to herself. Then she returned to the car and asked the driver to send someone to bring flowers to her father's tomb. She wanted his grave to always be pretty. While they continued to Molly's house, Anna leaned toward the driver. He could smell her liquored breath as she divulged a secret. She was going to have a little baby.
"My goodness, no," he replied.
"I am," she said.
"Is that so?"
"Yes." Detectives later confirmed the story with two people close to Anna. She had also confided to them the news of her pregnancy, yet no one knew who the father was. One day that summer, a stranger with a chaplain-esque mustache showed up in Greyhorse to offer his assistance to the private eyes. The man, who was armed with a .44-caliber snub-nosed English bulldog, was named A.W. Comstock, and he was a local attorney and the guardian of several Osage Indians. Some locals thought that Comstock, with his aquiline nose and tan complexion, might be part American Indian, an impression that he did little to discourage as he built up his legal practice.
The fact he represented himself to be an Indian would make him get along pretty well with the Indians, wouldn't it? Another lawyer skeptically remarked. William Burns had once investigated Comstock for allegedly assisting an oil company in a scheme to bribe the Osage Tribal Council for a favorable lease, but the charge was never proven. Given Comstock's numerous contacts among the Osage, the private eyes now took him up on his offer to help. While the detectives were trying to establish a connection between the slayings of Charles Whitehorn and Anna Brown, Comstock passed on tidbits that he collected from his network of informants. There was chatter that Whitehorn's widow, Hattie, had coveted her husband's money. Chatter that she'd been jealous of his relationship with another woman. Was it possible that this woman was Anna Brown? Such a hypothesis led to the next logical question. Was Whitehorn the father of her baby? The detectives began to follow Hattie Whitehorn around the clock, relishing being able to see without being seen. Operatives shadowed Mrs. Whitehorn to Oklahoma City from Pawhuska, left Oklahoma City with Mrs. Whitehorn for Guthrie, trailed Mrs. Whitehorn, Tulsa, to Pawhuska. But there were no developments. By February 1922, 9 months after the murders of Whitehorn and Anna Brown, the investigations into the cases seemed to have reached a permanent impasse. Pike, the detective Hale had enlisted, had moved on. Sheriff Frias was also no longer leading the investigation. That February, he was expelled from office after a jury had found him guilty of failing to enforce the law. Then, on a frigid night that month, William Stepson, a 29-year-old Osage champion steer roper, received a call that prompted him to leave his house in Fairfax. He returned home to his wife and 2 children several hours later, visibly ill. Stepson had always been in remarkable shape, but within hours he was dead. Authorities, upon examining the body, believed that someone he met during his excursion had slipped him a dose of poison, possibly strychnine, a bitter white alkaloid that, according to a 19th-century medical treatise, was endowed with more destructive energy than virtually any other poison. The treatise described how a lab animal injected with strychnine becomes agitated and trembles, and is then seized with stiffness and starting of the limbs, adding, "These symptoms increase till at length it is attacked with a fit of violent general spasm in which the head is bent back, the spine stiffened, the limbs extended and rigid, and the respiration checked by the fixing of the chest." Stepson's final hours would have been a hideous torment. His muscles convulsing as if he were being jolted with electricity. His neck craning and his jaw tightening. His lungs constricting as he tried to breathe until at last he suffocated. By the time of Stepson's death, scientists had devised numerous tools to detect poison in a corpse. A sample of tissue could be extracted from the body and tested for the presence of an array of toxic substances, from strychnine to arsenic. Yet in much of the country, these forensic methods were applied even less consistently than fingerprint and ballistic techniques. In 1928, a survey by the National Research Council concluded that the coroner in most counties of the United States was an untrained and unskilled individual and had a small staff of mediocre ability and with inadequate equipment. In places like Osage County, where there was no coroner trained in forensics and no crime laboratory, poisoning was a perfect way to commit murder. Poisons were abundantly available in products found on the shelves of apothecaries and grocery stores, and unlike a gunshot, they could be administered without a sound. And the symptoms of many toxic substances mimicked natural ailments. The nausea and diarrhea of cholera, or the seizure of a heart attack. During Prohibition, there were so many accidental deaths caused from wood alcohol and other toxic brews of bootleg whiskey that a killer could also spike a person's glass of moonshine without ever arousing suspicions. On March 26, 1922, less than a month after Stepson's death, an Osage woman died of a suspected poisoning. Once again, no thorough toxicology exam was performed. Then, on July 28th, Joe Bates, an Osage man in his 30s, obtained from a stranger some whiskey, and after taking a sip, he began frothing at the mouth before collapsing. He, too, had died of what authorities described as some strange poison. He left behind a wife and 6 children. That August, as the number of suspicious deaths continued to climb, many Osage prevailed upon Barney McBride, a wealthy 55-year-old white oil man, to go to Washington, D.C., and ask federal authorities to investigate. McBride had been married to a Creek Indian, now deceased, and was raising his stepdaughter. He had taken a strong interest in Indian affairs in Oklahoma, and he was trusted by the Osage. A reporter described him as a kind-hearted, white-haired man. Given that he also knew many officials in Washington, he was considered an ideal messenger. When McBride checked into a rooming house in the Capitol, he found a telegram from an associate waiting for him. "Be careful," it said. McBride carried with him a Bible and a .45-caliber revolver. In the evening, he stopped at the Elks Club to play billiards. When he headed outside, someone seized him and tied a burlap sack tightly over his head. The next morning, McBride's body was found in a culvert in Maryland. He had been stabbed more than 20 times. His skull had been beaten in, and he had been stripped naked, except for his socks and shoes, in one of which had been left a card with his name. The forensic evidence suggested that there had been more than one assailant, and authorities suspected that his killers had shadowed him from Oklahoma. News of the murder quickly reached Molly and her family. The killing, which the Washington Post called the most brutal in crime annals in the district, appeared to be more than simply a murder. It had the hallmarks of a message, a warning. In a headline, the Post noted what seemed to be increasingly clear: conspiracy believed to kill rich Indians. 6. Million Dollar Elm. Even with the murders, they kept on coming, the greatest oil barons in the world. Every 3 months at 10 a.m, these oil men, including E. W. Marland and Bill Skelly and Harry Sinclair and Frank Phillips and his brothers, pulled into the train station in Pawhuska in their own luxurious rail cars. The press would herald their approach with bulletins. Millionaires special due to arrive. Pawhuska gives city over to oil men today. Men of millions await psychological moment. The barons came for the auction of Osage leases, an event that was held about 4 times a year and that was overseen by the Department of the Interior. One historian dubbed it the Osage Monte Carlo. Since the auctions had begun in 1912, only a portion of Osage County's vast underground reservation had been opened to drilling, while the bidding for a single lease, which typically covered a 160-acre tract, had skyrocketed. In 1923, the Daily Oklahoman said, "Brewster, the hero of the story, Brewster's Millions, was driven almost to nervous prostration in trying to spend $1 million in 1 year. Had Brewster been in Oklahoma, he could have spent $1 million with just one little nod of his head." In good weather, the auctions were held outdoors on a hilltop in Pawhuska in the shade of a large tree known as the Million Dollar Elm. Spectators would come from miles away. Ernest sometimes attended the events, and so did Molly and other members of the tribe. There is a touch of color in the audiences, too, for the Osage Indians often are stoical but interested spectators, the Associated Press reported, deploying the usual stereotypes. Others in the community, including prominent settlers like Hale and Mathis, the Big Hill Trading Company owner, took a keen interest in the auctions. The money flowing into the community from the oil boom had helped to build their businesses and to realize their once seemingly fantastical dreams of turning the raw prairie into a beacon of commerce. The auctioneer, a tall white man with thinning hair and a booming voice, would eventually step under the tree. He typically wore a gaudy striped shirt and a celluloid collar and a long flowing tie. A metal chain connected to a timepiece dangled from his pocket. He presided over all the Osage sales, and his moniker, Colonel, made him sound like a veteran of World War I. In fact, it was part of his christened name, Colonel Ellsworth E. Walters. A master showman, he urged bidders on with folksy sayings like, "Come on, boys, this old wildcat is liable to have a mess of kittens." Because the least valued oil leases were offered first, the barons usually lingered in the back, leaving the initial bidding to upstarts. Jean-Paul Getty, who attended several Osage auctions, recalled how one oil lease could change a man's fate. It was not unusual for a penniless wildcatter, down to his last bit and without cash or credit with which to buy more, to bring in a well that made him a rich man. At the same time, a wrong bid could lead to ruin. Fortunes were being made and lost daily. The oil men anxiously pored over geological maps and tried to glean intelligence about leases from men they employed as rock hounds and spies. After a break for lunch, the auction proceeded to the more valuable leases, and the crowd's gaze inevitably turned toward the oil magnates, whose power rivaled, if not surpassed, that of the railroad and steel barons of the 19th century. Some of them had begun to use their clout to bend the course of history. In 1920, Sinclair, Marland, and other oil men helped finance the successful presidential bid of Warren Harding. One oil man from Oklahoma told a friend that Harding's nomination had cost him and his interests $1 million. But with Harding in the White House, a historian noted, the oil men licked their chops. Sinclair funneled, through the cover of a bogus company, more than $200,000 to the new Secretary of the Interior, Albert B. Fall. Another oil man had his son deliver to the secretary $100,000 in a black bag. In exchange, the secretary allowed the barons to tap the Navy's invaluable strategic oil reserves. Sinclair received an exclusive lease to a reserve in Wyoming, which, because of the shape of a sandstone rock near it, was known as Teapot Dome. The head of Standard Oil warned a former Harding campaign aide, I understand the Interior Department is just about to close a contract to lease Teapot Dome, and all through the industry it smells. I do feel that you should tell the President that it smells. The illicit payoffs were as yet unknown to the public, and as the barons moved toward the front of the million-dollar elm, they were treated as princes of capitalism, the crowd parting before them. During the bidding, tensions among the magnates sometimes boiled over. Once, Frank Phillips and Bill Skelly began to fight, rolling on the ground like rabid raccoons, while Sinclair nodded at the colonel and walked off triumphantly with the lease. A reporter said, "Veterans of the New York Stock Exchange have witnessed no more thrilling scramble of humanity than the struggling group of oil men of state and national repute throw themselves into the fray to get at the choice tracts." On January 18, 1923, 5 months after the murder of McBride, many of the big oil men gathered for another auction. Because it was winter, they met in the Constantine Theater in Pawhuska. Billed as the finest building of its kind in Oklahoma, the theater had Greek columns and murals and a necklace of lights around the stage. As usual, Colonel started with the less valued leases.
"What am I bid?" he called out. "Remember, no tracts sold for less than $500.
A voice came out of the crowd.
"500. "I'm bid 500, Colonel boomed. "Who'll make it 600? Five going to six. 5, 6. 5, 6. Thank you. 6, now 7. 6, now 7.
Colonel paused, then yelled,
"Sold to this gentleman for $600.
Throughout the day, bids for new tracts steadily grew in value. 10,000, 50,000, 100,000. Colonel quipped,
"Wall Street is waking up."
Tract 13 sold for more than $600,000 to Sinclair. Colonel took a deep breath.
"Tract 14,
he said, which was in the middle of the rich Burbank field. The crowd hushed. Then an unassuming voice rose from the middle of the room.
"$500,000.
It was a representative from the Gypsy Oil Company, an affiliate of Gulf Oil, who was sitting with a map spread on his knees, not looking up as he spoke.
"Who'll make it 600,000?
Colonel asked. Colonel was known for his ability to detect even the slightest nod or gesture from bidders. At auctions, Frank Phillips and one of his brothers used almost imperceptible signals, a raised eyebrow or a flick of a cigar. Frank joked that his brother had once cost them $100,000 by swatting a fly. Colonel knew his audience and pointed at a gray-haired man with an unlit cigar clamped between his teeth. He was representing a consortium of interests that included Frank Phillips and Skelly, the old adversaries, now allies. The gray-haired man made an almost invisible nod.
"$700,000,
cried Colonel, quickly pointing to the first bidder. Another nod.
"$800,000,
Colonel said. He returned to the first bidder, the man with the map, who said,
"$900,000.
Another nod from the gray-haired man with the unlit cigar. Colonel belted out the words,
$1,000,000.
Still, the bids kept climbing.
"$1,100,000, now 12,
Colonel said.
"$11,000, now 12, now 12.
Finally, no one spoke. Colonel stared at the gray-haired man who was still chewing on his unlit cigar. A reporter in the room remarked, "One wishes for more air." Colonel said,
"This is Burbank, men. Don't overlook your hands."
No one moved or uttered a word.
Sold, Colonel shouted, for $1,100,000.
Each new auction seemed to surpass the previous one for the record of the highest single bid and the total of millions collected. One lease sold for nearly $2 million, while the highest total collected at an auction climbed to nearly $14 million. A reporter from Harper's Monthly magazine wrote, "Where will it end? Every time a new well is drilled, the Indians are that much richer." The reporter added, "The Osage Indians are becoming so rich that something will have to be done about it." A growing number of white Americans expressed alarm over the Osage's wealth, outrage that was stoked by the press. Journalists told stories, often wildly embroidered, of Osage who discarded grand pianos on their lawns or replaced old cars with new ones after getting a flat tire. Travel magazine wrote, "The Osage Indian is today the prince of spendthrifts. Judged by his improvidence, the prodigal son was simply a frugal person with an inherent fondness for husks." A letter to the editor in The Independent, a weekly magazine, echoed the sentiment, referring to the typical Osage as a good-for-nothing who had attained wealth merely because the government unfortunately located him upon oil land which we white folks have developed for him. John Joseph Matthews bitterly recalled reporters enjoying the bizarre impact of wealth on the Neolithic men with the usual smugness and wisdom of the unlearned. The accounts rarely, if ever, mentioned that numerous Osage had skillfully invested their money, or that some of the spending by the Osage might have reflected ancestral customs that linked grand displays of generosity with tribal stature. Certainly during the Roaring Twenties, a time marked by what F. Scott Fitzgerald called the greatest, gaudiest spree in history, the Osage were not alone in their profligacy. Marland, the oil baron who found the Burbank Field, had built a 22-room mansion in Ponca City, then abandoned it for an even bigger one. With an interior modeled after the 14th-century Palazzo d'Avanzati in Florence, the house had 55 rooms, including a ballroom with a gold-leaf ceiling and Waterford crystal chandeliers, 12 bathrooms, 7 fireplaces, 3 kitchens, and an elevator lined with buffalo skin. The grounds contained a swimming pool and polo fields and a golf course, and 5 lakes with islands. When questioned about this excess, Marland was unapologetic. "To me, the purpose of money was to buy and to build. And that's what I've done. And if that's what they mean, then I'm guilty." Yet in only a few years, he would be so broke that he couldn't afford his lighting bill and had to vacate his mansion. After a stint in politics, he tried to discover another gusher, but failed. His architect recalled, "The last time I saw him, I think he was just sitting on a nail keg of some kind out there northeast of town. It was raining, and he had on a raincoat and rain hat, but he was just sitting there kind of dejected. 2 or 3 men were working his portable drilling rig and hoping they might find oil. So I just walked off with a lump in my throat and tears in my eyes." Another famed oil man in Oklahoma quickly burned through $50 million and ended up destitute. Many Osage, unlike other wealthy Americans, could not spend their money as they pleased because of the federally imposed system of financial guardians. One guardian claimed that an Osage adult was like a child 6 or 8 years old, and when he sees a new toy, He wants to buy it. The law mandated that guardians be assigned to any American Indians whom the Department of the Interior deemed incompetent. In practice, the decision to appoint a guardian to render an American Indian, in effect, a half-citizen, was nearly always based on the quantum of Indian blood in the property holder, or what a state Supreme Court justice referred to as racial weakness. A full-blooded American Indian was invariably appointed a guardian, whereas a mixed-blood person rarely was. John Palmer, the part Sioux orphan who had been adopted by an Osage family and who played such an instrumental role in preserving the tribe's mineral rights, pleaded to members of Congress, "Let not that quantum of white blood or Indian determine the amount that you take over from the members of this tribe. It matters not about the quantum of Indian blood. You gentlemen do not deal with things of that kind." Such pleas inevitably were ignored, and members of Congress would gather in wood-paneled committee rooms and spend hours examining in minute detail the Osage's expenditures, as if the country's security were at stake. At a House subcommittee hearing in 1920, lawmakers combed through a report from a government inspector who had been sent to investigate the tribe's spending habits, including those of Molly's family. The investigator cited with displeasure Exhibit Q, a bill for $319.05 that Molly's mother Lizzie had racked up at a butcher shop before her death. The investigator insisted that the devil had been in control of the government when it negotiated the oil rights agreement with the tribe. Full of fire and brimstone, he declared, "I have visited and worked in and about most of the cities of our country, and am more or less familiar with their filthy sores and iniquitous cesspools. Yet I never wholly appreciated the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, whose sins and vices proved their undoing and their downfall, until I visited this Indian nation." He implored Congress to take greater action. "Every white man in Osage County will tell you that the Indians are now running wild," he said, adding, "The day has come when we must begin our restriction of these monies, or dismiss from our hearts and conscience any hope we have of building the Osage Indian into a true citizen." A few congressmen and witnesses tried to mitigate the scapegoating of the Osage. At a subsequent hearing, even a judge who served as a guardian acknowledged that rich Indians spent their wealth no differently than white people with money did. "There is a great deal of humanity about these Osages," he said. Hale also argued that the government should not be dictating the Osages' financial decisions. But in 1921, just as the government had once adopted a ration system to pay the Osage for seized land, just as it always seemed to turn its gospel of enlightenment into a hammer of coercion, Congress implemented even more draconian legislation controlling how the Osage could spend their money. Guardians would not only continue to oversee their ward's finances. Under the new law, these Osage Indians with guardians were also restricted, which meant that each of them could withdraw no more than a few thousand dollars annually from his or her trust fund. It didn't matter if these Osage needed their money to pay for education or a sick child's hospital bills. "We have many little children," the last hereditary chief of the tribe, who was in his 80s, explained in a statement issued to the press. "We want to raise them and educate them. We want them to be comfortable, and we do not want our money held up from us by somebody who cares nothing for us. He went on, "We want our money now. We have it, it is ours, and we don't want some autocratic man to hold it up so we can't use it. It is an injustice to us all. We do not want to be treated like a lot of little children. We are men and able to take care of ourselves." As a full-blooded Osage, Molly was among those whose funds were restricted, though at least her husband Ernest was her guardian. It wasn't only the federal government that was meddling in the tribe's financial affairs. The Osage found themselves surrounded by predators. "A flock of buzzards," as one member of the tribe complained at a council meeting. Venal local officials sought to devour the Osage's fortunes. Stick-up men were out to rob their bank accounts. Merchants demanded that the Osage pay special, that is, inflated, prices. Unscrupulous accountants and lawyers tried to exploit full-blooded Osage's ill-defined legal status. There was even a 30-year-old white woman in Oregon who sent a letter to the tribe, seeking a wealthy Osage to marry. "Will you please tell the richest Indian you know of, and he will find me as good and true as any human being can be." At one congressional hearing, another Osage chief named Bacon Rind testified that the whites had "bunched us down here in the backwoods, the roughest part of the United States, thinking we will drive these Indians down to where there is a big pile of rocks and put them there in that corner." Now that the pile of rocks had turned out to be worth millions of dollars, he said, "Everybody wants to get in here and get some of this money." 7. This Thing of Darkness. In the first days of February 1923, the weather turned violently cold. Icy winds cut across the plains and howled through the ravines and rattled tree branches. The prairie became as hard as stone. Birds disappeared from the sky, and the grandfather's son looked pale and distant. One day, two men were out hunting 4 miles northwest of Fairfax when they spotted a car at the bottom of a rocky swale. Rather than approaching it, the hunters returned to Fairfax and informed authorities, and a deputy sheriff and the town marshal went to investigate. In the dying light, they walked down a steep slope toward the vehicle. Curtains, as vehicles often had back then, obscured the windows, and the car, a Buick, resembled a black coffin. On the driver's side, there was a small opening in the curtain, and the deputy peered through it. A man was slumped behind the steering wheel. "He must be drunk," the deputy said. But as he yanked open the driver's door, he saw blood on the seat and on the floor. The man had been fatally shot in the back of the head. The angle of the shot, along with the fact that there was no gun present, ruled out suicide. "I seen he had been murdered," the deputy later recalled. Since the brutal slaying of the oil man McBride, nearly 6 months had passed without the discovery of another suspicious death. Yet as the two lawmen stared at the man in the car, they realized that the killing hadn't stopped after all. The corpse was mummified by the cold, and this time the lawmen had no trouble identifying the victim, Henry Roan, a 40-year-old Osage Indian who was married with 2 children. He'd once worn his hair in 2 long braids before being forced to cut them off at boarding school, just as he'd been made to change his name from Roan Horse. Even without the braids, even entombed in the car, His long, handsome face and tall, lean body evoked those of an Osage warrior. The lawmen returned to Fairfax, where they notified the justice of the peace. They also made sure that Hale was informed. As the mayor of Fairfax recalled, Roan considered W.K. Hale his best friend. Roan was one of the full-bloods whose financial allowance had been officially curtailed, and he had often asked Hale to advance him cash. "We were good friends, and he sought my aid when in trouble," Hale later recalled, adding that he'd given his friend so many loans that Roan had listed him as the beneficiary on his $25,000 life insurance policy. A couple of weeks before his death, Roan had phoned Hale, distraught. Roan had learned that his wife was having an affair with a man named Roy Bunch. Hale went to visit with Roan and tried to console him. Several days later, Hale bumped into Roan at the bank in downtown Fairfax. Roan asked him if he could borrow a few dollars. He was still morose about his wife, and he wanted to get a drink of moon liquor. Hale advised him not to buy any whiskey. "Henry, you better quit that. It's hurting you." And he warned him that the Prohibition men were going to get him. "I am not going to bring any to town," Roan said. "I will hide it out." Roan then disappeared until his body turned up. Once more, the macabre rituals began. The deputy and the marshal returned to the ravine, and Hale went with them. By then, darkness had enshrouded the crime scene, and the men lined up their vehicles on the hill and shone their headlights down into the depths below, into what one law enforcement official called truly a valley of death. Hale remained on top of the hill and watched as the coroner's inquest began, the men bobbing in and out of the silhouetted Buick. One of the Schoenbrother doctors concluded that the time of death was around 10 days earlier. The lawmen noted the position of Roan's body, his hands folded across his breast and his head on the seat, and how the bullet had exited through his right eye and then shattered the windshield. They noted the broken glass strewn on the hood and on the ground beyond. They noted the things he carried, $20 in greenback, $2 silver dollars, and a gold watch. And the lawmen noted nearby tread marks in the frozen mud from another car, presumably the assassin's. Word of the murder rekindled the sense of prickly dread. The Osage chief, which in the same issue happened to carry a tribute to Abraham Lincoln as an inspiration to Americans, stated on its front page, "Henry Roan shot by unknown hand." The news jolted Molly. In 1902, more than a decade before meeting Ernest, she and Roan had been briefly married. There are few surviving accounts detailing the relationship, but it was likely an arranged marriage. Youths, Molly was only 15 at the time, pressed together to preserve a vanishing way of life. Because the marriage had been contracted according to Osage custom, there was no need for a legal divorce, and they simply went their own ways. Still, they remained bound by a memory of a fleeting intimacy that had apparently ended with no bitterness and perhaps even some hidden warmth. Many people in the county turned out for Roan's funeral. The Osage elders sang the traditional songs for the dead, only now the songs seemed for the living, for those who had to endure this world of killing. Hale served again as a pallbearer, holding aloft the casket of his friend. One of Hale's favorite poems echoed Jesus' command in the Sermon on the Mount. Man's judgment errs, but there is one who doeth all things well. Ever throughout the voyage of life, this precept keep in view. Do unto others as thou wouldst that they should do to you. Molly had always assisted the authorities, but as they began looking into Roan's death, she became uneasy. She was, in her own way, a product of the spirit of American self-construction. She arranged the details of her past the way she tidied up her house, and she had never told Ernest, her instinctively jealous second husband, about her Osage wedding with Roan. Ernest had provided Molly support during these terrible times, and they had recently had a third child, a girl whom they had named Anna. If Molly were to let the authorities know of her connection to Roan, she would have to admit to Ernest that she'd deceived him all these years. And so she decided not to say a word, not to her husband or the authorities. Molly had her secrets, too. After Roan's death, electric light bulbs began to appear on the outside of Osage houses, dangling from rooftops and windowsills and over back doors, their collective glow hollowing the dark. An Oklahoma reporter observed, "Travel in any direction that you will from Pawhuska, and you will notice at night Osage Indian homes outlined with electric lights, which a stranger in the country might conclude to be an ostentatious display of oil wealth. But the lights are burned, as every Osage knows, as protection against the stealthy approach of a grim specter, an unseen hand that has laid a blight upon the Osage land and converted the broad acres, which other Indian tribes enviously regard as a demi-paradise, into a Golgotha and field of dead men's skulls. The perennial question in the Osage land is, who will be next?" The murders had created a climate of terror that ate at the community. People suspected neighbors, suspected friends. Charles Whitehorn's widow said she was sure that the same parties who had murdered her husband would soon do away with her. A visitor staying in Fairfax later recalled that people were overcome by paralyzing fear, and a reporter observed that a dark cloak of mystery and dread covered the oil-bespattered valleys of the Osage Hills. In spite of the growing risks, Molly and her family pressed on with their search for the killers. Bill Smith confided in several people that he was getting warm with his detective work. One night, he was with Rita at their house in an isolated area outside Fairfax when they thought that they heard something moving around the perimeter of the house. Then the noise stopped. Whatever, whoever it was, had disappeared. A few nights later, Bill and Rita heard the jostling again. Intruders, yes, they had to be, were outside rattling objects, probing, then vanishing. Bill told a friend, "Rita's scared," and Bill seemed to have lost his bruising confidence. Less than a month after Roan's death, Bill and Rita fled their home, leaving behind most of their belongings. They moved into an elegant two-story house with a porch and a garage near the center of Fairfax. They bought the house from the Dr. James Schoen, who was a close friend of Bill's. Several of the neighbors had watchdogs which barked at the slightest disturbance. Surely these animals would signal if the intruders returned. "Now that we've moved," Bill told a friend, "maybe they'll leave us alone." Not long afterward, a man appeared at the Smith's door. He told Bill that he'd heard he was selling some farmland. Bill told him that he was mistaken. The man, Bill noticed, had a wild look about him, the look of an outlaw, and he kept glancing around the house as if he were casing it. In early March, the dogs in the neighborhood began to die, one after the other. Their bodies were